Are there heroes in today's Britain? Well, if there are, my guest in this episode of Ideas Have Consequences is surely one of them.
Lawrence Fox is leader of the Reclaim Party, and he got banned from Twitter for putting together four of the pride flags on his bio, making, rather conveniently, a swastika flag.
Morning, guys. In London's knife-ridden capital city, where a 15-year-old girl was stabbed to death with a sword, we've got one, two, another three upstairs stealing, going through my house to intimidate me, because this is what the police are. They don't police with consent anymore. They police with fear and intimidation.
As much as I'm a Christian and I believe that there is a life after death, and I believe in salvation, I believe in all these things, I also believe that the world you live in can't just be a lie. You can't just say the right thing for the right amount of money.
He's an acclaimed actor, activist, musician, and to the woke mob, he's just bloody annoying. Indeed, he might be the most dangerous man in Britain. Now, I'd seen him in the occasional movie or TV show, Gosford Park, Colditz, Inspector Lewis, The Professor and the Madman, and as Hunter Biden in My Son Hunter. But it was this ad that put him on my radar as a sensible political activist.
Right, here we go. It's been a strange 12 months in which we've given up so many of our personal freedoms in the name of the common good. Now, look, whether you agree or disagree with how things have been handled, the one thing that we can agree on is that we find ourselves here, now, today, not tomorrow and not yesterday, thank God, today. So what are you going to do? Well, I am going to stand to be mayor of this beautiful city that stands at the heart of this warm, welcoming, and tolerant nation. Why? Well, I want to reclaim your freedom. I want to reclaim your freedom to work when you want to work, where you want to work, and how you want to work, and remove all the obstacles that stand between you and rebuilding after these lockdowns. And I want to reclaim your freedom to move.
Now, you've got to recall the context of this ad. It was during the pandemic. And I saw this and I recognized him as a British actor, but as an activist, as a candidate for mayor of London, that came as a complete shock to me. But this ad just resonated with my soul. No sensible person could find anything objectionable in this ad. It's just about freedom. That's all it was about. So I followed him and I tweeted it, calling for people to vote for this man. And he graciously followed me. Now, fast forward to January of this year, and I'm in a London hotel cafe. And guess who walks in? Mr. Lawrence Fox himself. And it is my pleasure to have you with me on the Ideas Have Consequences today. Lawrence, how are you?
Thanks so much for having me. I am, I'm okay. I'm all right. I've just got back from a week of skiing with my kids. It's amazing that you essentially have to now pay money to stop your children staring at phones.
There's a very common sense reason gold is pushing to an all-time high right now. Actually, there are several reasons. The cost of goods continues to rise despite interest rate controls by the Fed. I mean, since January 21, cost of living is up 17.9%. The national debt continues to skyrocket, now above $34 trillion, causing many to wonder when this house of cards will come crashing down, and a presidential election this year that will have massive implications on the future of this country. All of this adds up to instability and uncertainty, and that is why so many Americans are turning to Birch Gold Group. Have you diversified your savings yet? Secure a portion of them with gold from Birch Gold. Text IDEAS to 989898 and get your free info kit. You'll learn how to convert an existing IRA or 401k into a tax-sheltered IRA in gold, and it doesn't cost you a penny out of pocket. With an A-plus rating from the Better Business Bureau and tens of thousands of happy customers, you can count on Birch Gold to do the same for you. Just text IDEAS to 989898 to claim your free info kit and to protect your savings from uncertainty today. My children are older than yours, and so they were kind of at the front end of all this. In those days, it wasn't phones quite so much. In the 90s and early 2000s, it was Game Boy, you know, sitting and playing the Nintendo and that sort of thing. Today, it's a much more dangerous world because every vile thing can be pipelined straight into their brains through through cell phones.
Yes, and it is. It's a it's astonishing what gets pumped into their heads, and it actually does. It creates an enormous amount of stress in children. Being able to have such access to phones, it's very difficult for us to stop it as parents because we're obviously very connected as well. But to a child, I think it makes them very, very stressed. And it also means that the only stress relief that they can find is from the screen. So the cure is the disease.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, with adults too, it seems to me that modern media is designed just to keep us all in a constant state of hysteria, anxiety, fear. And I know that one way that you find a bit of relief is through smoking. And I have to ask you this question. You're a man who likes good cigars. And I have to say, I really enjoy, I was in Havana just a couple of years ago this month. I was at Cohiba, and they gave me a pile of Cohiba cigars, which I brought back. And of course, you're in a country where you can get them. You can't get them in the United States. But I have to ask you, what's your favorite cigar?
I really like a Trinidad, you know. And I don't know much about the Trinidad, other than the fact that someone recommended it to me. But it's really lovely, sort of creamy, medium-bodied. And also really expensive, which is annoying. I gave up smoking cigarettes to smoke cigars. So I thought I'll just smoke a cigar once every 3 or 4 days, and that will maybe cure my smoking habit. I ended up smoking 2 55-pound cigars a day. And so I had to give up that habit. Go back to smoke.
Well, you know, when I saw you in London, you know, my favorite cigar shop in London is, you know, your namesake, J.J. Fox. I mean, what an incredible place. We just don't have anything comparable to that in the United States, those kind of cigar lounges. But what an amazing place. Perhaps next time in London, we can enjoy a cigar together at J.J. Fox. Now, let's start with this. Richard Dawkins, he's a guy that I know. I've moderated some of his debates at Oxford University and elsewhere. I've certainly engaged him an awful lot privately, publicly. He's been kind enough to host me in his own home. And he made a lot of news this past week with a statement that the very Christianity that he has devoted his career to destroying, he now says he laments its decline in Britain. And no doubt it's because he senses like Ray Bradbury that something wicked this way comes. But how do you react to Dawkins' statement?
I think he's emblematic and symptomatic of a lot of what's going on in people's hearts and minds in our country at the moment, which is built very much on the Judeo-Christian model. And all of our laws and everything around that, the institutions that come out of those laws and the education system we provide and all of these things come out of this Judeo-Christian system. So I think what he's probably doing is doffing a cap to the past where life had meaning, even for those who live in a world of ethics. He's sort of drawing into something a bit deeper, which is about meaning. And I think that those games that people like Richard Dawkins played, you know, very wonderful, incredibly smart man, and I admire him hugely in lots of ways. I think they're coming to bite them. Progressive thinking is taken such a violent turn to the point where your average person can see it, let alone Professor Dawkins, that he's going, oh, there's danger. This way lies, as you quite rightly said. It was Mao's revolution. It was the children and young people that were brought out to become the killers. And we're not miles away from that in this country with these huge levels of completely brain dead, brainwashed activist children who are coming after the very things that generation after generation before them fought to protect. And it's almost a terrifying situation to be in the United Kingdom, I think, and the West more broadly.
I agree with that. I mean, when you have a woman who's standing in front or near, just near an abortion clinic, you know the incident I'm referring to. Her eyes are open. She's on public property. She's not on the abortion clinic's property, and they arrest her because she might be praying. And in the meantime, we have Muslims who are throwing down their prayer carpets and stopping traffic all over Europe, and no one dares arrest them. And even a guy like Dawkins has to recognize the culture is changing very rapidly. And maybe, as he said in an interview with the Times of London in 2010, perhaps Christianity has served as a bulwark against something much worse. And I think that there are many people, I like the way you put it, I think there are many people who are recognizing that the Christian faith has indeed played that role. But you are, in a sense, fighting for the preservation of Christian civilization. Is that a fair characterization?
I think I'm fighting for a world that I would like my children to grow up in and to have a chance of succeeding in. And I think that this, one of the things that got thrown out with the progressive movement was this idea that there was a covenant between each generation and the next, that you passed on the world well-maintained, well-looked after, and cherished, which has vanished, totally vanished, because no one wants to look after their own life, let alone, they're much more interested in sorting out other people's. So I'm fighting to go to my kids who happen to have white skin, that should not affect their chances of getting a job, and that should not affect their chances of being taken seriously in a conversation, that they should not be blamed for the historical wrongs of every single human being, of every single ethnicity, skin color, and race, just because they happen to have white skin. And it's reminiscent of you know, segregationist and Jim Crow America, what's happening just in reverse. And it's very bad for people, because what it does is it emboldens black racists like Ibrahim Kendi, and we've got several of them here who are just openly racist black people. It emboldens them because there's no bulwark against that. You can't say, well, you're being racist, because their critical race theory tells them that they can't be racist, and they're taught this stuff in school. So yeah, I'm still looking for any part of the Western canon that has not been utterly and totally corrupted. And when I find it, I'm going to breathe a huge sigh of relief, because I can't see where any protection is coming from for us. All of us.
I've received many messages from the posse that you guys do not get notified when new episodes come out on YouTube, even though you might have been ringing that bell icon. It's no secret that we are covering sensitive topics here on YouTube that these mega corporations don't really agree with. In other words, they have reasons to suppress what we're saying on this platform. You might not know this, but I have a weekly newsletter that will notify you when there are new episodes of Ideas Have Consequences. This is the best way to stay up to date on all that I'm doing. You'll get new episodes, documentaries, articles I'm writing, courses, and other exclusive content straight to your inbox every week. Go to join.larrytaunton.com. That's join.larrytaunton.com to join the newsletter, or you can simply look for the link in the description below this video. Back to the podcast. Yeah, for our American audience, Britain, if you don't know this, Britain is much further gone than is America, but America is rapidly following exactly the same path. You said this, and you know, I mentioned that you're a musician, and before the interview, when we were just chatting, I told you that my wife and I were listening to some of your music last night, and in a song, a popular song called the distance, you say this: the light has been turned down on the age of reason, replaced by blinding fires that burn wild across the region. For the wrong to rule, the good must just stand idly by. So you made a decision that you weren't going to stand idly by. You made a conscious decision, I'm going to engage. And one of the things that I've so admired about you from afar, I haven't known you personally. We haven't had that opportunity to smoke that cigar. But my heavens, the media has come after you with knives drawn and with laughable. I read a couple of pieces, or tried to, in The Guardian that were so vicious, so dripping with venom, that they're just laughable. They just weren't journalism in any meaningful form. And you're just a guy who just keeps going. You just keep going. What made you decide to engage in a fight you had to know was going to get bloody like this?
I think, as much as I'm a Christian and I believe that there is a life after death, and I believe in salvation, I believe in all these things, I also believe that the world you live in can't just be a lie. You can't just say the right thing for the right amount of money, because then you're part of this system, which you are so disgusted by. I mean, you know, I understand that there are earthly laws and earthly systems, but I'm disgusted by the system that says that in order to earn money and in order to succeed in this world, you have to lie. So I thought, I can't lie anymore. There's no point. I earned good money acting, but I didn't feel that I would be able to change my view on something just for money. I think there's probably so much more in life. And actually, it's been shown to me that if you refuse to lie, then you are free in a way that you may to other people seem agonizing, because it is in many ways, but in a deep, deep sense, you're free in a way that other people never will be.
Give us a concrete example how in acting you might be asked to lie, carry the water, as it were, for the leftist radical agenda.
Well, you'd be asked to acknowledge your white privilege within acting. You'd be asked to acknowledge systemic racism and all of this stuff current. None of it passed. I mean, because it would be quite easy for people to acknowledge that systemic racism was part of Western societies up until even the late 60s, I would say, and, you know, homophobia beyond that. But the examples would be something like BAFTA saying that they're going to have 50-50 representation of what they call Black and Asian ethnic minorities. Sorry, I've got a pregnant dog here. Maggie, don't do that. Black and Asian ethnic minorities, they just lump everyone who isn't white into a group, and they say that they're going to have quotas. So the equity agenda in show business is very, very strong. I had a few, I on my last ever acting job before the Hunter Biden, which was my sort of sabbatical from cancellation, there was some very rich young women of color complaining about how oppressed they were. And I was like, you're earning £20,000 a week. This is not oppression. If you want to know what oppression is, then I suggest you go to one of these places that you talk about so much. You know, go to the Badlands, but don't sit on a movie set and complain about systemic racist oppression when you're being paid £20,000 a week and you're flying in and out on a private jet.
You might appreciate this story. I was invited by a Nigerian bishop to Nigeria. And Nigeria is arguably, at least in the north, one of the most dangerous countries in the world, and certainly for Christians who have been slaughtered there. It barely makes headlines in the West, but they're being slaughtered by the Fulani herdsmen militia and the Boko Haram, both of which are radical Muslim sects. And so I did go, and they had to hide me. And It was an incredible experience. What I saw, the stories I heard, which were tragic, inspiring, horrifying. So I invite that bishop to come to the United States. And you have to bear in mind that he speaks with sort of that sonorous, old school British accent, as it was a British colony, of course, as you know. And he hasn't been touched by the PC movement, not at all. So I bring him to the U.S. to speak, and he is speaking to an American, a black man who is talking of his oppression. And you have to know that the bishop is hearing this with a completely different perspective on this. And when the man is done telling him of how hard it is to be a black man in America, the bishop says to him, "Has anyone raped your wife?" And the man says, "No." "Put your sons to the machete?" "No." "Taking your daughters into sex slavery?" "No." "Burned your home?" "No." "Prevented you from making a living?" "No." He said, "Well, then what you're telling me is some people have called you names. In my country, people who share your skin color will kill you simply because you do not speak the same tribal language." And you could have heard a pin drop. It was a remarkable exchange, and it provided so much perspective to people who haven't really been anywhere and don't really have an understanding of what oppression really is, and who have bought into a narrative of oppression. I've always said that it's hard to convince people of anything except that they're victims. It's very easy to convince a man that all of his problems are due to someone else's, viciousness directed towards him. What would you say for you? Would you say that you're willing to resist the way you have is due to a product of personality, just your character? You have the reputation as a rebel preceding this. Or would you say that it's your core convictions, or a bit of both?
It's interesting. I would say that nowadays, if I was taken into a psychiatrist's office, I'd probably be diagnosed with some sort of personality disorder or autism spectrum or something like that. My personality has always been one. My grandmother used to call me Mr. Logic. And if things didn't make sense, I would have a big problem with them. And I think essentially what I do is I apply a kind of very severe logic to things, while at the same time trying to apply a sense of humor to them as well. And I think that's why, one of the reasons why I'm hated so much by the mainstream media, because they are so desperate to turn me into Adolf Hitler. But I'm actually a bit of a kind of, I have some sort of fairly left-leaning political thoughts as well as right-leaning political thoughts. So I think I'd probably upset them because I represent, and I'm articulate enough to represent, the concerns and feelings of quite a lot of people in this country. If, me walking through the streets of London is anything to go by, because whenever I do, I get stopped by people who say, "Why aren't there more people doing what you're doing?" So I think it's probably a mixture. It's definitely nature in the fact that I'm born unable not to analyze things in a straight and logical way. And B, I was nurtured by my mother to distrust every system that is not fair on people. So, I was young when I realized that the National Health Service was a complete disaster of an idea, because my mother worked in the National Health Service, and she explained how it worked to me. And I went, "Well, that doesn't sound fair or right." And she was like, "Yeah, well, it isn't." So it's a combination of both, I think. And it's a great testament to my parents that they raised us all to express ourselves freely. And, you made this example of this bishop. The thing that this guy, this American guy who's saying that he's oppressed, this black guy is doing, is he's advocating for the world that the bishop has left. He's advocating for a tribal world where people will kill each other based on the most stupid of things, language, skin color. That's what he's advocating for. And, you know, to see in 2024 the West be so defenseless against identitarianism and tribalism is, you know, to be fair to us all, should make us really ask ourselves, why are we so infectious to this disease, susceptible to this disease of progressive tribalism and utopian compassion and or whatever this inclusion drive is? It's a very spooky thing. And why are we all so available to it? And I think when you mention my song, "For the Wrong to Rule, the Good Must Just Stand Idly By," that's what's happened. A lot of good people have just stood idly by and done nothing. And we've now got to a situation where the world, the loudest voices in this world, are the most extreme over almost every issue. And I, who try and adopt, I'm provocative, so I accept that I'm provocative, but I adopt a pretty centrist view on most things, that I am a Nazi now. That's strange to me.
Well, and the very people who would say that you're a Nazi or a fascist are themselves the Nazis and fascists. I mean, that's part of their methodology. We're going to accuse people of being the very things that we are. We're going to accuse him of racism when we're the racists. We're going to accuse him of extremism when we're the extremists. This is exactly what they do. But, you know, you come from a famous acting family, and it would have been easy for you, at least, I mean, from my perception from here, I might be mistaken in this, but it seems like it would have probably been easy for you to sort of coast along, accept the narrative, or at least not go against it, and for your career to just flourish in every way, shape, or form, and live a pretty easy life. And that just wasn't in your nature. It just wasn't your DNA. Something I suspect in your conscience just so simply wouldn't allow you to do that. And the result of that has been that you are attacked relentlessly, viciously by the left. They've tried to embarrass you at every turn. They mock at every turn. Again, it's not real journalism. They've tried to leverage your family against you, as you've just said, try to paint you as some sort of fascist or Nazi, which of course you're not, and you just keep going. Did you have a red pill moment, or would you say that you were always kind of red pilled?
My major red pill moment, the big wake up, was Brett Kavanaugh. That was my big wake up. Was people I formerly respected saying believe all women, to me, is the most insane orthodoxy anyone could ever adopt. You don't believe anyone for any reason whatsoever, ever. And if there is a dispute, it's examined in the court. You don't just go, I was raped, I can't remember when, I think it happened one of these summers, it was at someone's house and I don't really know whose house it was. And, you know, I'm not sure exactly what happened, but it definitely did happen and it's really bad. And you've got a guy who's, you know, a judge. Now, I'm not saying that people are, you know, just because you're a judge, your moral probity is big. But this guy was just sat there, and clever people were saying, you got to believe the woman. And I'm like, absolutely never believe a woman or a man who makes an allegation which isn't backed up with all of the evidence in the world, because otherwise you live in anarchy. So I think that's where I got, where it began. And then I started thinking about things like Barack Obama, just in this annoyingly logical way that I have, which was, America was told that America was systemically racist as a nation. So what the people of America did, because America's the most beautiful idea that mankind has come up with so far, is America said, let's right this wrong. So they voted in a black president, well, a mixed race president, who's half white as well, twice. And in that time, that president used his position, the position of every one of the Americans, Republican and Democrat and independent, who voted for him, to instantiate division, identity politics, and a hatred of the other side in an argument. And I thought, you're the worst thing that's happened to America. I mean, Joe Biden is obviously utterly the worst thing that's happened to America. But all of the seeds of this.
Well, you see, he's being controlled by Obama.
Yeah, he's Obama's pet, isn't he? You know, and not a very good one at that. So but that was what really got me. I started thinking, hang on, even when people want to, got sunlight beaming through the window. Even when you've got people who really want to listen. So America wanted to listen, and it wanted to say, you know what, we do have this history, and we aren't proud of what we've done. And we want to show that we are a genuinely progressive, inclusive society. So they vote in a very charismatic, inspiring guy who then uses his position to destroy the nation that voted him in. I think is unforgivable, actually. And it made me realize that the difference between what they call the right and the left is just those that will talk and those that won't. And I will talk to anybody about anything at all. As long as we can, obviously feelings come into a conversation, but you try and base it in some sort of empiricism. But the left, as it's burgeoning now and as it's sort of postulating now, is it's only interested in feelings. It's not interested in genuinely how the bricks of society that Richard Dawkins really cares about are held together. And they're held together by things like trust. And they're held together by things like, you know, companionly human love. And they're held together by the institutions that were built in the glorification of God. And now that they've gone, we can see what human nature is really like, what's just under the surface. And it's very, very unpleasant.
Well, it seems to me that what guys like Dawkins want to do, though, and others like him, is they want to keep the product of Christianity while getting rid of Christianity. They want to kick out the legs of the chair while keeping what sits on it. And to me, that's so absurd. I mean, it's like saying, you know, I really love the warmth of the sun. I just could do without the sun itself. Yeah.
It's really hard, that one, because, I struggle with, I have a weekly conversation with Calvin Robinson, and we talk, and he talks about the Christian faith and how bad I am at it. So I think that there's two things, right? People, I think your spiritual self is private, deeply private thing, but your public facing moralistic, you know, embodiment of your inner spiritual values is important. And what you're referring to is what things like GB News are doing, and things like the Reform Party in the UK and stuff are doing, which is adopt this what I call loosely liberal conservatism, which is the secular version of what you're describing, which is to take off the four legs of the table and just leave the top, which is useless to everybody. So they give in on free speech, and they give in on debates over the climate change, and they give in on anyone who says anything even vaguely hurty towards the religion of peace. So I think it's what Dawkins is doing, and what everyone is sort of doing to a degree, is grabbing for something that's solid. And they don't really care whether they have to take the fact, you know, that Calvin would insist on, you know, many sins that I and everyone else don't commit all the time. But at the same time, their outward, what's going on inside is going to be mirrored in what's going on outside. So I think what you're seeing is Richard Dawkins start to go, oh Lord, maybe you do exist.
Well, I think things are starting to get a little dicey in North Oxford, where he lives, because again, he sees something much more insidious coming. And for all of his railing against the Christian faith, he doesn't have very much to say, at least that's not very carefully stated, when it comes to the so-called religion of peace, Islam. So I find that very interesting. I want to come back to something you were just saying, though, and I really appreciate you saying it. You know, Calvin, I am familiar with him. We almost met up in Rome. I think it was last year. He was there at about the same time that I was. And just it didn't quite work out. But, you know, we're all bad at being Christians in a sense, those of us who have given our lives to Jesus Christ, because Christianity begins with a premise that human nature is seriously broken. And that, of course, is what you're experiencing and what you're seeing. It begins with the premise that we are innately evil and we need the restraint of Jesus Christ in our lives if we're to be anything that looks even remotely good. I like what Evelyn Waugh, you know, the British writer, said. If somebody told him what a horrible human being he was, and he said, and imagine how much worse I would be if I were not a Christian. You know, so I think of my own Christian faith not making me good per se, but making me just a little less evil, because we all have to live with a certain measure of hypocrisy in our lives because we simply cannot live up to the law. We are not capable of living up to the law, but we endeavor to do so. And as that fixed point in society is jettisoned, and I say fixed point because I think of a quotation from Blaise Pascal, you know, who was an atheist and who became, you know, was a Renaissance, I mean, a real Renaissance man. He was, could do almost everything, philosopher, artist, scientist, you name it, but he was an atheist who became a Christian. And he said this, and this is kind of a loose quotation. He said, when everyone is moving towards depravity, it seems like no one is moving towards depravity. But if one man stops, he becomes a fixed point for all the others. And he goes on to say, we must have a fixed point in morality. A harbor serves as a fixed point for those who are aboard a ship. What shall be our fixed point in morality? It was a rhetorical question because he was referring to Jesus Christ. But you're so right, because people are looking for, you know, that handhold, something to hold on to. And when you annihilate belief in God, which this is what the left is seeking to do, just as they did in Russia, just as they did in China, just as they did in North Korea, just as they've done in dozens of countries all over the world, what is left is the state defines morality. And that, of course, is what they want. And when people are willing to accept the notion, to swallow the absurd pill that men can be women and women can be men, that you can lop off the penises of adolescent boys and turn them into little girls, the state has won, because you've reached a level of absurdity. Well, you will accept absolutely anything that you are told. And I think that a guy like Dawkins recognizes maybe science, maybe science itself has to be rooted in a fixed point that goes beyond the tangible.
I think you're exactly right. And what they're most clever at, our friends on the left, is words. So I suppose you were asking earlier about my red pilling moment, if you will. I'm an actor. I studied words and I'm good at them. And I know what I'm doing with words and I know what they mean. And I know what, you know, I know what, how, when they're put together, what they do. So this attack on religion, which is the later attack, the first attack is an attack on words and the meaning of words. And they've gone in so hard on this man-woman one. You know, we had a gay rights activist in the UK this morning saying that the Chinese game hunting bird, the pheasant, could turn from female to male. And they're constantly coming up with these sort of half-truths, you know, of seahorses giving birth that the male carrying the seahorse children. But there is good and there is evil. And that is a binary. And there's everything in between, but there's good and there is evil, in the same way as there's man and there is woman. And it's important. The reason why the Christian faith is so good is because it starts from exactly the position you stated, which is that we're all fallen. We're all grossly bad. And we have to do everything to make ourselves better. That's the exact opposite of progressivism. Progressivism is, you're bad and I'm going to make you do what I say to make you better. And that, as you quite rightly pointed out, has led to the deaths of hundreds of millions of people the world over. It's destroyed individualism, and it's destroyed the bond between all of us as those who suffer. And if we saw ourselves in that situation as individuals that suffered, that can collectively work together, you actually have the beginnings of a society. But what the state will do is it says, yes, no, I agree with you. We're all bad and we need to make it better. Let me tell you what to do. It's like, no, it's a conversation. And it's a conversation that needs to be based, as you said, there needs to be handrails. And one of the handrails is the binary of sex. The other one is that are very, very simple binaries that people refuse to talk about, which is it doesn't matter what color your skin is. It's what's going on inside your heart that is important. It doesn't matter to Jesus or to God what color your skin is. It doesn't care at all. And the third one is to measure the success of this experiment that society is taking part in, it's forcing itself to take part in, which is the meaning experiment. And we've removed all of the meaning. And we've just been left with, it's sort of violence now. You know, they keep saying words of violence and misinformation, disinformation, all this sort of stuff. But this is a precursor to violence. That's what's happening. They're going, we tried really nicely to get you to tell us, to get you to say that the boy with his dick chopped off was a girl. We tried nicely, but now if you're not going to listen, that's hate speech. And if you're not, then you're going to go to jail. Because we can't, and it's like, okay, you're disrupting the force in quite a substantial way. And I'm not going to sit by and let you do it. So ultimately, weirdly, our fallenness is going to be our greatest defense, because the only thing progressivism cannot tolerate is humor and mockery. It likes to be taken very, very seriously. And if you refuse to take it seriously and you mock it, not only do you celebrate the fact that God gave you a sense of humor and that you're a totally unique individual all by yourself, you make other people smile. And that's what people really want in life. Life is very, very hard on very, very many people. And we need to find the moments of levity in it.
You know, Lawrence, you are very articulate, and it's obvious in an interview like this. And of course, I've seen it in many other things. It's one of the things that I very much like about you. But it's also why let me just offer I know you know this, but let me offer these words of encouragement to you. It is because you're articulate, because you're quite obviously intelligent, that the left has to destroy you. They have to destroy you. You're formidable. You have a platform. You're good at leveraging your platform. I think you're also good at admitting mistakes. I think that's so refreshing when somebody says, you know, I probably shouldn't have said that. You know, maybe I shouldn't have done that. Maybe that wasn't the best course of action. I personally find that refreshing, because there are so many arrogant people who will never admit that they're wrong about anything. But you're attracting so much fire because you're formidable. And I saw that, you had said in an interview some time ago that you didn't, and actually you've even kind of said it here, that if you were to, you know, have to go to a psychiatrist or a counselor, they would say maybe there's something wrong with you. Well, of course they would say that, because they'd probably be paid to say that. I don't know if you know him, but a friend of mine here, political figure, here in the United States, Dinesh D'Souza, who's highly intelligent, he's superbly educated. Dinesh is one of those guys, when he's sitting in my living room and we're talking, there are conservatives who are very thoughtful. Dinesh is brilliant. Dinesh is genuinely an honest-to-goodness intellectual. And the Obama administration had one of their radical judges declare that he was insane, you know, and he had to sit under house arrest and this kind of stuff. He absolutely is not. He was an enemy of the regime, and they feared him because he had published a book called The Roots of Obama's Rage, which was dead on, absolutely dead on. When he laid out for me in my home the thesis of that book and asked me to punch holes in it, I thought, I can't find any. I think you're spot on with this. So when you say that you feel that you're a little unhinged, that you might be, my response to that, again, we haven't smoked that cigar, though I hope we do, and I hope I get to know you. I wonder if it isn't just a case of, you know, Klaus Schwab, in one of his books, I actually read his books, which are a cure for insomnia. They're like reading, you know, TV manuals. But he says that essentially this, he couches it in terms that are, you know, a little unclear deliberately, but he says that basically we have to create a kind of enforced loneliness among dissenters, among the anti-globalists. And I wonder if a guy like you doesn't start, because, you know, what was that song by Matchbook? What are they called? Matchbox 20 or whatever the name of the song was. I'm not crazy. I'm just a little, unsettled, or however the lyrics to that song go. That may, what's that?
Is it Misunderstood? I think I know the song.
Yes. I'm not crazy. I'm just a little unwell. I'm just a little unwell. I'm wondering if you aren't feeling a little of that deliberate, orchestrated, enforced loneliness, where there's an effort to cancel you, and you start thinking, am I the only guy who thinks like that? Am I actually the one who might be? I've been in those circumstances where you start wondering if it's just you. You know, maybe I'm just being too difficult here. Maybe I'm behaving like an ass. I just think you need the encouragement of being around some sensible people, because me just spending, I was partially educated in London as an undergrad. It was a very different London 30 years ago. It was my favorite city on the planet. I loved London. I recall going through Sainsbury's, and I was clearly lost, and this very nice woman, elderly woman, started helping me determine I was a poor American student. And she and her husband invited me over. Turned out he was in the Battle of Britain, and I just sat and listened to these extraordinary stories of these people. And that was the Britain that I knew. I met so many people like that. And the Britain I know now is completely different. And brother, I just tell you, I just think you need the encouragement of like-minded people.
It's been the Britain you describe, this experiment in multiculturalism, which was forced on us from Blair, has been such a catastrophic failure. And the sad thing is, you may just about bump into somebody in Sainsbury's now who's got a house around the corner who fought in the Battle of Britain, but chances are there are entire areas of London which are not even remotely, even vaguely British. So, and you know, you say this and you're called a racist, and it's like, I'm not saying I'm not making a value judgment on it. I'm just saying to you, where once were people who fought in the Battle of Britain living house by house by house by house by house, there's no longer. There is now people who have no seeming affinity with this country or its values, which creates problems, as we see with these marches in London all the time. And we've created a divided tribalist nation as a result of it. And it's bad. You're right. You do need, they are trying to, it's almost like good people I loved say it's like a demonic attack. You're being attacked, and you know, you have to ride it out. It's it is very hard, though. I have to say I find it very difficult practically, more than anything. You know, I worry about things, and one shouldn't really worry. One should do. And I find myself getting trapped in fear. Not fear so much, I'm not frightened, but I worry. I go, well, what happens next in my logical brain? So if this happens and people stop having faith in the police, what's the next iteration of the events that will unfold as a result of that? Or if a man is sent to jail for 5.5 years for harassing a BBC, ex-BBC journalist in the UK, does that seem proportionate to boys who sexually assaulted a girl and got less time in prison? It's like, what is the next iteration of looking at a justice system which is meant to be blind and it isn't? It's then people start taking the law into their own hands, and that doesn't end well. You know, it's the Mike Tyson.
Well, as you've said, violence is the next step here, and the violence is already happening, and it's happening in this country and in that country where, you know, Americans, British people, usually white people, are being assaulted, raped, and this sort of thing, and there's virtually no consequence for those people who are doing it. So the left is using them already as their shock troops, almost like their brown shirts, to bring about the radical change that they want to bring about. And Something else that you brought up that I think is interesting, at least that you touch on in talking about the woke mob and their agenda and what they're doing. You have made commentary that I think is dead on, that the church has failed many Christians. And that would be in Britain, that would be in the United States, and that is because many, perhaps for very sordid reasons, maybe to protect their own fiefdoms, perhaps for money, perhaps for fame, many Christian leaders, so-called, have gone along with the woke agenda. But I think that there's another group that have mistaken a woke ideology as having some kind of affinity with the Christian faith. And there's absolutely zero in common between the two. And the first place I would go to is that the Christian faith, as we've discussed in just this interview, is about redemption. The woke mob, they don't care about redemption. It is all about retribution. There is no coming back for you. They want to destroy you. And those people who think that this is about some kind of public repentance and a rapprochement and bringing about some kind of reconciliation in society, that is not what they want. And I think you're just dead on in what you're saying about Barack Obama bringing division in this country. That was the whole point of it. These are Saul Alinsky kind of tactics. This is Reverend Wright speaking hate, but just in more genteel tones. That's what has happened there. Let me ask you another question here, Lawrence. You have referred to yourself as a lapsed Christian. Would you still say that's true?
I use it as a sort of lazy way of saying that I'm not denominational particularly, and I don't really go to church very often. So I'm sort of, I was raised, my father was an evangelical Christian, is still, I think, an evangelical Christian, but he's old now, so he doesn't go on about it so much. I just use it as a way of saying that I don't want to, one has to be very careful with faith in a way, because for the exact reason that you said, which is that we're all fallen. So I try not to justify or think about the things I do based on my faith or the fact that God is telling me to do something. I try and base it on the fact that I'm doing what I do in the full knowledge that I'm created by God, rather than ascribing him the responsibility for what I do. Do you know what I mean? And I think that makes it more difficult.
Yeah, I do.
It makes it harder to we've got a real problem, and the problem's not going to go away, which is that you have two faiths that were separated and have fought for the millennia. Well, not millennia, but, a very, very long time, best part of over 1,000 years. And they were kept apart by geography. And that's changed now. And religions don't have borders, but we still have to love our Muslim brothers and sisters who live amongst us, especially the Richard Dawkins Muslims, the ones that just hold on to the good parts of the religion of peace. So we have this huge problem, and I don't see how anybody has a solution to it other than to turn around and say, in this country, our systems, our organizations, our structures, and our institutions are built around the Christian faith, whether this is a Christian country or not, even though we do have a Church of England. But as you say, the Church of England has so utterly betrayed Christianity itself, in the same way as Sadiq Khan, who calls himself a Muslim mayor, has utterly betrayed the Muslim faith himself by his endorsement of the trans ideology and even homosexual ideology, which 50% of British Muslims think that homosexuality should be illegal, whereas that's in contravention to the laws of our land. We're going to have at some point, someone's going to have to stop saying you're Islamophobic for wanting to talk about it, but we're going to have the conversation about how these two faiths are going to get on in what is essentially a secular liberal democracy. How are these faiths going to interact? Because you cannot bring in blasphemy laws like they've done with the Batley Grammar School teacher, with the hate crimes bill in Scotland, with all of the legislation they're trying to bring in to clamp down on the right of people to disagree with each other. And that's the bit that's really terrifying. And, you know, even for my own father, who I speak to a lot about this, he really struggles with the idea of what do you do? There's a huge number of Muslim people in this country. Do they not deserve love as well? And I'm like, yeah, of course they do. But what does the country run on? What gas is the country running on? Is it running on, you know, Christian petrol, or is it running on Muslim diesel? Because one will break the engine.
It's very well put. You know, when I think of your father, a great actor, I remember him in Russia House. But, you know, the image that comes to my mind is him slipping down in that tub in the Sherlock Holmes movie. So interesting. So good. You know, if this question is too personal, Lawrence, just brush it off. Just tell me so. But I'm curious as to where your conversations with Calvin, who I admire, by the way, are with him as you discuss your own faith, as you discuss your thinking in this, because these lyrics are, you know, are a few years old. They go back to maybe 2019, 2020. But I told my wife last night as we were listening to some of your music, which I very much enjoyed. I say that with great sincerity. I really, really enjoyed it. It was very pleasant. I enjoyed the thoughtfulness of the lyrics. And I've always been a guy, probably like you, when I was a kid, I would argue about lyrics. I would say, I mean, if you listen to what that guy is saying and imagine, I mean, he's basically saying our lives are completely meaningless. You strike me as a searcher, and that's been a few years ago. So your life may be in a very different place now, but what comes across in the lyrics is almost a little like, you know, Kansas's dust in the wind. There's a quality of a guy who is very thoughtful, who is figuring out the matrix and saying, hey, a lot of this stuff is fraudulent and I don't like it. Is that a fair characterization of where you are?
Yeah, I think it's a really good characterization of who I am, because I was sort of, obviously, straight after I decided to start speaking publicly about it, people came up to me and were like, wanted to use me as a spokesman or representative for whatever it was that they were doing. And obviously politics came around quite quickly after I'd started speaking. And I've never felt at home in this world of the political world at all. If anything, I find it, you know, about as shallow and naive and more dangerous than show business, because at least in show business, you're only going to be doing harm to the poor little actors and actresses that you would get under your spell. In politics, it's entire nations that you can destroy with your ideology. But yeah, I am a searcher. I'm searching for sense. I've been writing. I started to write because I need to. I can't, for some reason, I can't get inspiration to play music at the moment. So I started writing, and I was writing about the fact that I was very logical. And then I was also writing about the fact that when I was a kid, I was also a real pyromaniac. So I would burn things down all the time as well. So I think there's a sort of weird paradox going on in my head between the person who's searching and wants to solve and help, and someone who's saying we need to clear out all of the rot from this building or this place. You know, and I can't quite work out which one I'm meant to be. But as someone said to me, a woman said to me when I said, I don't understand how I ended up in this place. She went, it's not a job that you applied for. And I went, no. And she went, it's not something you ever thought you'd want to do. And I said, no. And she went, sounds like a calling to me then.
Well, it's well said. I don't want to keep you too long, but I do want to respond to that, because the sentiment that you just expressed, that you didn't feel at home in this world, that's a Christian sentiment. And I have found myself recently reflecting on, I think I want to use it, I'll tease it right here in perhaps an upcoming episode of this show, and that's Augustine's City of God, which may seem very, you know, esoteric and irrelevant to a lot of people today. But, you know, you go and read some of the theologians of 1,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago in the case of Augustine, the issues they're talking about are irrelevant. He reads as fresh today as when he was writing. And he wrote the City of God as Rome was being sacked by Germanic tribes, by invaders, foreign invaders. And he wrote it to remind a deeply unsettled Christian population, this is not your home. Your ultimate citizenship is not in Rome. It is in heaven above. And I've said that, you know, your ad, it just resonated with my soul. That's not an overstatement. It resonated with my soul. But what also resonated with me about you is your restless spirit. My wife describes me as endlessly restless and easily bored. And you very graciously, you had, that was a pretty heavy moment for you. That was a pretty heavy day that we connected in that hotel lobby. And you graciously were going to meet me for dinner, I think, the next day. And unfortunately, you know, I was off to Cairo. And that's kind of the nature of my life. So I identify with that restless spirit and searching spirit that I think I perceive in you. I want to suggest something here as we close this interview. Are you familiar with Professor Oxford University professor of mathematics, pure mathematics and philosophy of science, Dr. John Lennox?
I've heard of John Lennox, but I'm not familiar with him.
Okay, well, he is the C.S. Lewis of our time. And you ask Calvin about him, I promise you that he knows who he is. In fact, he was a student of C.S. Lewis's at Cambridge. And Lennox is a fascinating guy. He annihilated Dawkins in debate. He is, in addition to being a scientist and mathematician,
I know him.
You know who he is?
Yeah, I've heard him speak. I know him. He's brilliant.
I would love to arrange a meeting, just a private meeting, between you and Lennox sometime. He would love you. You would love him. He is a silver-tongued Irishman. And he's really, he's been a mentor really in my life, a real fatherly figure. And he's a force, but I mean, he's just a short distance from you at Oxford University. And I'd love to arrange a meeting if you're amenable to that. I'm sure Calvin probably has met him, probably knows him. Mm. If not, he should. I should arrange that meeting too. But if you're open to that, I'd love to arrange that sometime.
Very much.
Lawrence, it has been great to have you on this episode. You've been so gracious to do this, to come on the show, and I've just loved listening to you. You know, I think I want to get you to narrate my next book. I don't speak with a British accent, but who cares?
Before I got canceled, one day I think I earned over $250,000 for like an hour's work for doing a BMW advert and an Allianz insurance advert in one morning. So that was my and my world.
Well, still, maybe I can't afford you.
My world just felt empty and pointless. But I mean, it just goes to show. Do you know what I mean? That I sit here now and I worry about money and I worry about none of the things I used to have to worry about. I now worry about, and I'm grateful.
Well, I have some interesting ideas for you, but that's for a private conversation. But you have a marvelous voice. I love your voice, and yes, I think people should hear my next book in your very silvery tone. So I think that would be wonderful. Lawrence, it's been great to have you.
I will smoke loads of cigarettes so it gets even deeper.
Take care, brother.